I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And what we want to do is bring manufacturing back to our country. Vice President Pence, good morning, is very much involved with me on that. It's one of my most important subjects. It's what the people wanted. It's one of the reasons I'm sitting here instead of somebody else sitting here.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, America's doing okay. It seems they've weathered the pandemic and inflation better than many, but there's a lot that's wrong with America as well. I mean, many people in America are very poor. Many are in prison. They die earlier than most Western countries. And are they losing their way in manufacturing, being beaten at their own game by China? And when it comes to aircraft, the Europeans. So have they just got lazy? Apart from the Magnificent Seven, outside software, is there anything America is good at these days? Or is it a nation in decline? We'll look at that this week on the Debunking Economics Podcast. So there are lots of signs that the US is doing well. So the GDP per capita in 2022 was over $76,000 compared to less than $55,000 in Canada, for example, $46,000 in the UK, $36,000 in France, $15,000 in Russia. So I'm glad they're suffering a bit. Unlike most places, that US figure has been growing quite sharply. So their GDP per capita is improving. Consumer spending is rising, up 0.8% in February, for example. They have an unemployment rate of just 3.8%, one of the lowest in the world. The inflation rate is now just a little over 3%, one of the first to come down. In the US equities market, it's growing its share of all the global equities to such a point that countries are now seeing their local share markets decimated. And a lot of that is because of AI and big tech, the world's biggest growth sector, dominated by the magnificent Seven, so Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, Apple, Alphabet, Amazon, and Tesla, all American. On the downside, they've got a high balance of trade deficit, $69 billion just for the month of February. It has a lower value of exports per capita than the UK, Australia, and Germany. So in 2022, they exported $8,760 per capita compared to $15,000 for the UK, almost $18,000 for Australia and $25,000 for Germany. And it has the reserve currency, which is seen as a bit of a safe haven with a lot of secure assets that can be invested in the US as well, including US treasuries. But Steve, we are also seeing gold prices now rising because Asian central banks have been buying it up. So this could be a prelude to relying less on the US dollar. So if the US dollar is being seen as less secure and reliable, like, for example, if they had a geriatric in charge or a mad egomaniac running the country, will the US continue along its merry way if the US doesn't continue to be the world's central currency? How bad does it get if that stops being the case?
Oh, look, I think that's a long way down the track because it's still obviously the dominant currency at the moment. And if the figures you're talking about, they're comparative figures for America's growth versus the rest of the world, it's, you know, nobody in commerce is going to be thinking about changing out of the dollar. Okay, if it's actually strengthening the dollar. So yes, if it lost its reserve currency status, then it would certainly have some serious problems potentially, because it's no longer the world's preeminent manufacturing country. It was after the Second World War. It sort of lost that to Japan, and then Japan lost its way with the bubble economy, which gave America a bit of a fillip after the collapse of the Japanese economy in 1990. And then along comes China. Now, China, yes, it's having its property problems, well and truly, but you've got fundamentally the two economies, both China and America, are both running with strong fiscal policies, you know, large amounts of government spending, large infrastructure projects. And this is what's, I think, the difference between America and the other Western countries, is that Biden seems to be a bit of a black box. You never not quite know what his motivations are, whereas Trump, you know, far too much. But it seems he's just basically saying, look, I'll make the necessary words to make people think, well, I concern myself about the deficit, but I'll just continue spending on the program I've put together. And from a modern monetary theory point of view, from a simple money creation point of view, that means the government's creating money, and wow, creating money helps the capitalist economy turn over effectively. So I don't see any danger of America losing the preeminent position as the international currency under current trends. That could change with different trends, but current ones, I think, are actually strengthening it rather than weakening it.
So, and they have to, actually, don't they? I mean, if they've got a, if they're exporting, you know, they've got this big balance of trade deficit, but there's a lot of demand for US dollars. If those US dollars aren't being created by the government, where are they coming from?
Well, they're being created by the government. The government is running a large deficit and hasn't cut back on it. The obsession about the whole debt ceiling nonsense is, you know, we've gone through that particular barrier yet again. Biden just seems to make the, you know, respect the debt ceiling, blah blah blah, and then continues on the other side once the political crisis has passed. So which is only caused by hitting a new miracle debt ceiling again. So you've got, you know, a strong fiscal stance and very high interest rates, which conventional economics sees as slowing the economy down, and it would if that was passed through to individual borrowing rates and hit the cost of credit for the private sector. But that's limited to some degree by the extent to which Americans have used fixed rate mortgage loans rather than variable. So you've got stimulus from the size of the government spending, stimulus for the financial sector from this, I mean, the rate of interest on government bonds, and the rest of the world, particularly Europe, is so obsessed about getting the budget deficit down that their money supply is growing more slowly. And wow, so is their economy. Who'd have thought?
Mm. And yet this low value of exports per capita than the UK, Australia and Germany. So,
but that can be seen another way. And this is one reason I use America whenever I'm doing an argument, whether I want to use an example, a statistical example. I'll almost always use American data, because even though I rubbish the Americans for the extent to which they fell for outsourcing and offshored manufacturing to the third world, and that's the large reason why China grew so successfully, was on the winning side of that trade. But so long as I rubbish it for that, it's still the world's most self-contained economy. And because it's so self-contained, then it doesn't need exports. As much as 30 years ago, Japanese cars were superior, they still made their own cars. The Australian economy, and that still applies today, obviously, and now we've got one of the world's premier manufacturers, Tesla, being American, and its only real rivals being Chinese.
Yeah.
But if Australia, you know—
Being surpassed by the Chinese, I should point out.
But Australia, if Australia could no longer import cars, then it would no longer have new cars, period. And that is one reason you've got a high level export dependence in those other economies. So you can grow courtesy of exports, but if you have, and this is what the Chinese economy, before they fell for the euro, the German economy too, you had a diversified industrial structure. You could produce almost anything. And for that, with that diversified structure, it also comes out as lower costs. So all the stuff the neoclassicals rave on about comparative advantage actually puts you in a worse situation. But America has fallen for that to some degree, but because it has such a complete economy, it's capable of surviving with a lower level of exports per capita.
Yeah. So I think what you're saying is if all of a sudden shipping stopped and there was no trade, America would do all right. The rest of us would be a bit stuffed, but America could continue on its merry way because it's largely a self-sufficient economy.
Yeah, then you've even on the oil, that was the one big hole in their portfolio until fracking, and now fracking is also a large number of big holes. But at the moment, at least, it means it can supply its own gas, gas and oil. So it's got a capacity to absorb dramatic falls in its exports or rise in its imports. And that's, of course, that's where the reserve currency status comes in. Other countries like, you know, Australia, the UK, even Europe, if they're running a trade deficit, then they undermine the value, the significance of their currencies. America, as Yanis argued in his The Global Minotaur, has to be in that situation to create the American dollars circulating in the rest of the world that enable the rest of the world to undertake commerce, because we all use the American dollar. So it's got this huge industrial base, diminished but still large enough to mean it produces most of its own needs. And then it's got the reserve currency, which means it can get away with running a deficit in trade in a way that other countries can't do.
Right. Well, in a way, it almost has to, doesn't it? If the US dollar is being used overseas, there has to be a lot more US dollars. I think we gave the figure. I mean, I need to go back and check, of 1 in 10 US dollar transactions actually involve the United States. There's got to be way more US dollars than is required by the country itself to satisfy international trade between countries. So all of that's got to be created by the US government somehow.
Yeah, and that, that, well, it's all by, you know, the banking sector. I mean, there's stuff to come out of. It's got to turn up in reserves. I think there can be. I have to look at the dynamics of it all. But it does require the running government running a deficit, and the deficit creates money. This is the thing that the mainstream can't get their head around. They don't understand money creation, so they're anti-deficit. What they're therefore against is against the creation of fiat money. Now, what both China and America are showing, the creation of fiat money spurs a large amount of both public and private sector activity. And those two economies, you know, China's looking fragile courtesy of the final collapse of its property bubble. But they've had rates of growth that are far greater than the European countries, which were obsessing about the deficit, are not creating a great deal of fiat money. There's not much credit money being created as well after we're still in the tail end of the impact of the global financial crisis on private sector borrowing. So we have the monetary taps have been strangled in the rest of the world. They're still running fairly effectively in America and China. And that's one reason, hey presto, when you measure them, yes, it's in nominal dollar terms, but they're still growing. The nominal dollars turn into real economic activity. So I don't see a dilemma for America coming out of losing its reserve status. It's other issues that are going to be important.
So on China, I spoke to a China expert for another podcast. He said, don't get too carried away or too concerned about this property debt in China, in that it was actually, the collapse of these companies was actually implemented by the government because they worried that it was all getting carried away and it needed to be stopped. And of course, you know, who will suffer? Well, the banks will, you know, pay for the default on debt. Who owns the banks? Oh yeah, the government
does. And that's a huge factor in its favor. You've got a private monetary system which makes private loans, but fundamentally that private money system is government owned, and if it's not government owned, you're bloody well government controlled, because the last thing you want to do is have the Communist Party knock on your door saying you didn't follow the most recent directive from the Central Committee.
And meanwhile, they're investing in the technology sector. They're investing in areas where they don't have to play catch up, because they can be in the same place as everywhere else, which is now why they are selling more electric cars than anyone else anywhere in the world. And, you know, I'm sure they'll do it in lots of other sectors as well. So just this US dollars being spent overseas, a lot of it comes back, of course, when people buy government bonds. 40% of US government bonds, the treasuries, are held by foreign investors. So what is there in it for the United States? And it's not just the United States, but they are leading. So Japan's bonds now are, 30% of those are held by foreign investors as well. And that's sort of like a facet of the last 20 or 30 years. And in the euro area, their bonds have sort of risen up to around 40% as well. So, but the US is still at the top of the pack, I think, in terms of foreign ownership. What's in it for the US in doing that? Or can they just not stop it happening?
They can't stop it happening, because what you've got going on there is bond sales in the secondary market. And this is the sort of thing which, neoclassical economists think they know this stuff. They don't. They're clueless with the way they analyze the monetary system. But with the when the government runs, you know, spends more than it takes back in taxes, which we call a deficit, that gap creates reserves on the one side of the bank balance sheets, and it creates deposits on the other side. So it creates money. Then the reserves used to earn no interest and still earn less interest than bonds do. So the sale, and if the government is simply running a deficit all the time, then its account at the central bank will go negative, because if you have, you know, spending going out, which is greater than tax coming in, and you weren't issuing any bonds, let's say, then at some point the spending being greater than tax would mean that the government's account, the treasury's account at the central bank, could go negative. Now, every government in the world pretty much has passed laws requiring that central bank account not to go negative. That's what bond sales do. So when the bond sales occur, the financial system as a whole has enough reserves to purchase the bonds. Put it this way: there's so many bonds outstanding already that there aren't enough reserves available to buy the current deficit. And this is, you know, even a deficit of 10% of GDP, let's say, which is about twice the American level, that would mean 1% of, you know, if you did just a monthly auction, that'd be less than 1% of GDP in terms of the level of sales. So all you need is reserves at that level. And of course, there's bonds which are 100%. All the central bank has to do is buy some of those bonds off the private banks to create the reserves. Therefore, the bonds can be purchased. There's no such thing as bond vigilantes, meaning bonds won't be sold. I'm being long-winded here. But the next point is, once the banks have bought that, they primary auction, they then sell those bonds, not all of them, but a fair slab of them, to other buyers, and that can be anybody. So the bonds that are turning up in foreign countries are most likely those which are sold on the secondary market by the banks and primary dealers themselves.
To investment funds that are looking and going, well, this is a secure place to stick our money. Yeah. Can't go wrong with U.S. Treasuries, or maybe even foreign central banks. Not foreign central banks, foreign banks as well, looking for a safe place to park their money. Yeah. So the effect of that, though, is if these bonds are being sold overseas, then that is US dollars being repatriated back to America.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly. So, and they come back and they end up in the financial sector, of course. So this is actually fueling the financial sector. I'd far rather feed the industrial sector than the financial, but that's the impact of those bonds being sold internationally. The on-seller of the bonds, whether that's a bank or a non-bank financial institution, sells the bonds and gets reserves as a result of the deposit accounts if they're a non-bank, reserves if they're a bank, and then both the banks that get the reserves back are then encouraged to buy more bonds, and the non-bank financial institutions get reserves are encouraged to buy other financial assets. So, you know, it fuels the financial engine in America, which is a bit like fueling Beazle Bub, but that's what they do.
Right. But what happens if, because China obviously is buying up a lot of these bonds, or has historically, starts to wind back? What if there's less interest in buying U.S. bonds, particularly from countries that think that the U.S. has got too much control and they want to diversify more? What happens then? Does that make any difference at all to the standing of the U.S.? And it just makes the U.S. financial sector a little less well off.
Well, yeah, but it also, what it will mean is, if that has any impact upon the reserve rate of interest, the interest rate that banks charge each other in the overnight market, then the central bank comes in and does some of the buying. And this is the huge hole. I mean, you remember the old song, there's a hole in the bucket, dear Eliza. the hole in the bucket of the neoclassical attitude towards government debt is that if there was ever any problem, the central bank could buy 100% of the outstanding bonds. Literally could do it. Because all they've got to do is say, oh, the total value of the bonds outstanding is, let's say it's, I don't know, $30 trillion. It's not quite that much. It's about 25, I guess, but they're 30 trillion. We're going to put the number 30 trillion in all the relevant bank accounts, the reserve accounts of the banks at the central bank, whether that's directly if they're actually dealing with banks, or indirectly if they're dealing with a non-bank financial institution that have bought bonds off the banks. Put 30 trillion in all those accounts and then record, oh dear, 30 trillion worth of bonds the Federal Reserve now owns. Oh, what's happened to the government's debt problem?
Yeah. All right. So what you're painting is a picture in all of this of infallibility. You know, that America...
Not, I wouldn't say infallibility, but I'd say invulnerability.
Yeah. All right. Well, when we come back, I just want to look at what, you know, what could potentially be going wrong. And whether actually all of these good points is making a country that's a bit lazy. And is that part of the problem for America as well?
So that is more of an issue, yeah.
So we'll look at all of that when we come back on the Debunking Economics podcast. It's me and Steve Keen back in a second.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So in the first part, we're talking about, you know, what a fantastic opportunity the United States has. And we know how well it's doing in big tech, for example, how so much of the world's investment now is in just seven companies, which are all American companies, and how stock exchanges around the world are suffering because of that. And, you know, the fact that the US keeps on issuing money, it's got in more than enough money to continue to see growth in the economy. But in this next part, I want to look at whether actually we're actually seeing that growth happening. So has America become lazy because of its position? And I think there's lots of evidence that there is. So I mentioned electric cars a few times. So Steve, and they don't like electric cars as much as the rest of the world, it's fair to say. So USC electric vehicle purchases in 2023 were half that of Europe. 1.6 million for North America compares to 8.4 million for China as well. You know, and you've been to the States. You see how they like these big, gas-guzzling large vehicles. And I think the fact that they are destroying the planet is part of the attraction for them. But they're making less cars. That's the interesting thing. So last year, the US made 10.6 million cars. In 2016, it was 12.2 million. Shouldn't that number be going up? Wouldn't you have thought that, you know, as there's a demand for, you know, this transition to electric vehicles, and they're making less than, you know, many other parts of the world proportionally that are electric, you would have thought that they would be stepping up production, wouldn't you?
You know, this is a classic technological shift, and partially this comes down to the nature of manufacturing and corporate management over the last 40 years. Because the obsession in corporate management, we're seeing it with Boeing right now, was to outsource everything, pay the minimum possible wages to your workers, rush stuff through production systems and so on. And because you're relying upon a diversified bunch of suppliers, you can't change things particularly quickly. But what's happening with Musk initially, and now the Chinese as well, they're vertically integrated. And so if they want to change something in the design, it's not a case of having to contact 50 suppliers to try to negotiate that they all change manufacturing the parts they put together in a coherent way. Pardon me. It's simply telling the production line down the end, we're changing. The production line tells the further, this is the change we're making. What do you guys have to do to adapt to it? So the vertical integration has worked extremely well for Musk, and it also seems to be working for the Chinese vehicle manufacturers that have come along as well. And technologically, they're leaving the rest of America behind.
Well, I mean, Musk is leaving America behind as well, isn't he? Because he's starting to, you know, put production facilities outside America. But how much behind? So, well, last year, 11 million, just under 11 million cars, as I said, in the United States, 30 million in China, I mean, China wasn't really making cars 5 years ago, not to any great degree. Now it's making 30 million of them a year, which is twice what Europe makes. Europe made 18 million last year, which is still a lot more than the United States. So, I mean, this big car manufacturer all of a sudden seems to have lost its way.
Yeah, I mean, and this is something which, I mean, I remember being involved in seeing the first free trade zones in China in 81, 82, and their entire intention was focused on getting the engineering nous from America, as well as developing their own local capitalist class. They did both extremely successfully. But the culture in China is dominated by engineers. The culture in America is dominated by economists, hiding to nothing that the engineers are going to win. And this is that orientation applies in the government. It applies in the private sector as well. So I think I remember seeing actually a clip of Musk actually being asked a question about today's leading Chinese automotive manufacturer, and he giggled, and then the person said, "Why?" And he said, "Have you seen their cars?" Well, the thing is, they've done exactly the same thing that Musk is doing with SpaceX, iterative design, and 5 years later, you're not laughing anymore.
No. Well, I'm driving a Chinese car. I'm driving a Chinese Volvo, and electric Volvo. It's a very smart car. It's got all the tech in there. It's, the drive is smooth. I mean, it's an impressive vehicle. What China now has, I mean, you of course all grew up thinking China means inferior goods. That's changed now, hasn't it? And the innovation is there as well. So that makes them a force to be reckoned with.
The funny thing is, I mean, if you go back far enough in history, they were actually stood for refined goods. And this is, you know, I'm not saying that China's have got a century and a half long memory. Maybe they have. But the reason we used to call crockery China is because the best crockery was made in China. When the British wanted to export to China to get these, you know, Chinese silks and Chinese crockery and so on, they didn't have anything the Chinese wanted except opium. And they then enforced the opium, selling of opium inside China, which led to the opium wars with China trying to prevent the opium coming inside the country for its own benefit. And the Americans and British fought to keep the opium trade open, and that helped destroy a large part of Chinese culture and so on. So, yes, it's a change. You know, Chinese goods are crap. They were crap because of the crap way they were treated by particularly Britain, but also America and France and so on in the colonial period. And they're basically reestablishing their preeminence they had back in the olden days. So in some ways, this is a return to normal.
So purchases of electric vehicles, 16% of all new cars in the UK are now fully electric. In Europe, it's 12%. In Norway, over 90% of all cars are either pure electric, new cars are either pure electric or hybrids. Haven't got the pure electric figure. But anyway, 16% in the UK is the interesting one, because in the United States, it's 7.6%. Now, we know if Donald Trump comes along, he's going to say, my goodness, 30 million cars, a lot of them electric, coming from China. We're only managing to sell 11 million cars. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to impose this 100% tariff on cars from China. And the effect of that is going to be, well, there's not a lot of interest in electric vehicles anyway. So they'll just that electric vehicle market will just dry up. Some people will buy a Tesla, but a lot of people continue using petrol and diesel cars in the United States because they've got lots of petrol, which they can get because they've got the reserves there from their fracking. So you can see how that's going to go. So they're going to do what they can to prop up their own industry, not helping the climate a great deal, though, are they, in the process?
No. I don't think anybody's helping the planet. The planet will help itself in a short while. That'll sort all the troubles out. It is crazy the extent to which Americans are still in the gas-guzzling mindset. So the European approach to electricity and electric vehicles and modernity is very much out of step with American thinking. But, you know, we're coming back to the strength of the American economy, and it is a weird mixture because it's got away with running its productive capacity down as much as it has because it's so big to begin with in the first place. And that is why you got those figures for the low, you know, proportion of exports per head or per exports compared to GDP. Yeah, it's just a sign of how big America was in the first place. But in some ways, if they're going to continue it, they've got to turn that outsourcing around again and get back to vertical integration and start producing domestically what they've ended up importing. But they've lost the skill base, and this is a huge problem. Whereas the Chinese have got an enormous reservoir of well-trained engineers, both in government and the private sector, who can build these infrastructure projects and come up with things like, within 5 years, go from producing no electric cars and being a laughing stock to being the world's largest manufacturer of electric cars and having some very satisfied customers.
So if you look on the FRED database at total manufacturing production for the United States and compare it to other countries, like the UK, for example, which we will often diss for not being a manufacturing-based economy. You look in the United States, though, around the year 2000, let me just blow it up so I can see it. Around the turn of the century, manufacturing production just flatlined in the United States. It's not been growing at all. If you look at it for the UK, it's still growing. So there's something going wrong when your manufacturing production just flatlines and has been for 2.5 decades. But that's where America is.
Yeah, like that's where I think the financial issue and the whole impact of being the reserve currency is a poison chalice, because it gives the financial sector enormous strength. And we're talking about ways in which that applies earlier in the show about the sales of bonds and so on, and the amount of cash that comes back when the bonds are bought by overseas countries and companies that are then used by the American financial sector for yet more purchases of assets and so on. So it gives enormous strength to the financial sector, but it cripples the manufacturing. And this is, again, one of my greatest laments is the fact that Keynes lost out to Harry Dexter White in Bretton Woods, because if that hadn't happened, we might have had the Bancor as an international currency, and we wouldn't have this bloated American financial sector. And at the same time, you wouldn't have the desiccated American manufacturing sector. So I'm wondering whether over 80 years' time, we're finally starting to learn the lesson that Harry was wrong and JM was correct.
And with that loss goes innovation disappears, doesn't it? As you say, because you haven't got engineers in charge. You've got the
and this is one reason. Like I know I've avoided talking about the MMT line, exports are a cost, imports are a benefit, for a long time, because I didn't want to kneecap the incredible success MMT has had at changing people's attitudes towards government spending and how government spending is financed. That's fabulous. But the exports are a cost, imports are a benefit is classic static trader advantage. You get a physical thing back in return for a piece of paper. That's a trade in your favor. It's a trader's perspective.
Not a money perspective, which is...
Not a money perspective. That's correct. Which is weird, but doubly weird is that it ignores the impact upon innovation and training. Because if you're getting, sending overseas pieces of paper and getting machinery back, you tend to forget to train people who can make machinery.
Yeah.
Whereas the reverse applies in China, incredible capability to design and engineer and manufacture, and that gives it a greater. Not just growth potential, which I think is going to become a dirty word in coming decades, but self-sustainability capability, and that's vital.
Well, maybe they're ahead of the curve then, because they're demonstrating, zero growth in manufacturing right now. But if you look at the airline sector, you mentioned Boeing, or Boeing, might be an appropriate name. Rubber planes, so that when they crash, they just bounce back up again. A bit uncomfortable.
We need a new band called Boeing Crash Opera.
They were an Australian band, weren't they? Might be a loss on a lot of people. Boom Crash Opera.
That was it. Yeah. Now it's Boeing Crash Opera.
From a while ago. Obscure Australian band from a while ago. But anyway, if you look back in recent history, Boeing and Airbus sold a similar number of planes each year. But now it seems like the wheels have fallen off It's the only thing that's been bolted on properly. And so I think there was an engine cover the other day as well. So it's just
engine cover flew off. Yeah.
So anyway, last year, Boeing 1,314 orders for aircraft and compared to 2,084 for Airbus. So they've got problems at Boeing as well, you know, given that they historically have been very similar numbers. So again, you know, here's an example, America losing its way of an industry that it was once very dominant in.
Yeah, and I think that's an important lesson of when you let the marketing types, and not the marketing, MBA types, take over a company. One fun incident from my earlier life before I became an academic, I used to be a journalist for a computer magazine and ended up interviewing Wayne Ratliff, who was the designer of DBase 2, which in the days was the dominant database language for PCs. And he literally got off the plane fuming about MBAs. Because he said Harvard MBAs had taken over Ashton Tate, which is the company that distributed DBase 2, and all they wanted to do was get revenue in through the door. And what Wayne wanted to do was get away from the very simplistic database structure of DBase 2 and go to what's called an entity relationship database structure, where you have entities, person and product, and the relationship is sale, and the relationship itself contains the data. It's a very sophisticated approach to database design. The company is going to be called Emerald Bay. And he could not get the MBA told him, no, don't do that. Just add more databases. So DBase 2 could handle two databases, DBase 4, I think it was four. Then you got DBase 10 that could handle 10 databases. But you still had to have the poor bloody programmer going through all the, if the loop to loop, internal loops, external loops, et cetera, et cetera. I used to program in the language, so I know it very well. Whereas the entity relationship is far superior. What happened to Ashton Tate and DBase 2? They've both folded. They've both disappeared. So by focusing upon profitability and return and sales rather than engineering and excellence, they screwed a great company and a great nascent product. And this seems to be happening across America. The MBA dominance, the money men rather than the engineers taking over. That's probably the greatest coup in the history of American capitalism and the worst.
Something else which is ignored is the rising inequality in America. So those in the upper income tier, if you had upper, middle and lower, they accounted for 29% of all the income in 1970. That rose to 48% in 2018, according to Pew Research. Lower income accounted for 10%. That's not really changed. The changes actually come in the middle and higher income earners. Middle income earners accounted for 62% of all income. That's now fallen to 43%. So middle America is losing out to the higher one-third of the population in terms of income. And if you look at the Gini coefficient, which, of course, you know, is a measure of the relative inequalities within a country. So zero means everyone has the same wealth, and one or 100% means that one person's got it all and everyone else has got nothing. Well, America is at 40%. So the worse it is, the higher the number, the higher the degree of inequality. So America's at 40% or 0.4. The UK and Germany are on 32%. Holland is less than 26%. I mean, there are worse places. South Africa's at 63%. But this inequality is bad in America, and it just seems to be getting worse. And there doesn't seem to be public policy which is addressing that. Because, and I think it's part of that is the American psyche that everybody should be able to get ahead. And if you've fallen behind, then that's your problem. But the good news is that you can get ahead. Even though it's impossible, everyone still believes they have a chance.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it as well. I mean, and like I'm thinking you'd find there's also, the elite doesn't really worry about the working class. There was even Paul Samuelson once described America as being characterized by rampant capitalists with a cowed working class. So you'd think that'd be coming out of the mouth of a Marxist rather than a person who, constructed the neoclassical edifice of today. But that's his realistic statement at one stage. And that basically means you're disparaging the poor. That's the poor that's your own problem, as you were saying in the inverse earlier. Whereas if you go to China and you go to Europe, not as extreme as China, but most other countries have some belief in a shared, a collective reality. Even Arnie Schwarzenegger. Arnie Schwarzenegger gave a speech saying about "Don't call me a self-made man," whereas the mythology of self-made man still dominates America. Equally, it means you've got a self-made failure. But when you have societies that talk about a need to make sure everybody, you know, we're collectively in this, we need to make sure everybody has opportunity, you get more opportunity coming out of that as a result in Europe and China than you get in the so-called land of opportunity, America.
Well, in Europe, we've got a sense of community, which they don't have in America.
I'm sure
I'll get shot down by Americans listening to this podcast, but I feel like, you know, there's the sense that you belong in your place a lot more in this country, and that means looking after everybody else in the community in which you live.
And then I recommend searching an Arnie Schwarzenegger, whatever they call it, closure speeches at American University, saying how much he was made by the contributions of other people, including the people he met at Gould's Gym when he turned up in America as an 18-year-old bodybuilder. So
I'm not a self-made man.
Amazing. But this belief in individuality, I think, is a large part of what's making America dysfunction, both for individuals and the collective.
Yeah. All right. And then it is this idea as well, isn't it, in America, that everything has to be done by private enterprise, and that doesn't always work. So life expectancy in America is 80. In the UK, it's 83. In Sweden, it's 84. You know where I'm going with this. Spain, it's 85, 5 years more than America. And yet health spending per capita in America in 2022 was $12,550. In the UK, it was less than $5,500. So they are spending well over twice as much as the UK, but they are dying 3 years earlier. That's free enterprise for you.
Yeah, there are,
they're the cold hard numbers.
Yeah, and there are so many elements like that. There are areas where, you know, you want the innovation to occur, definitely, but there are times when you look at the argument about it's all between a buyer and a seller, and you get to, you know, work out a marketplace that doesn't involve exploitation. When you face a life-threatening illness, and I have had that experience, you don't look for the cheapest person. You look for the one who's got the highest reputation. There's no way you've got any bargaining power in that situation. So you pay out a fortune, unless there's a government system to mean that everybody pays a similar amount with some flexibility. That's what the rest of the world has. America's called that socialist. The rest of the world calls it recognizing the power imbalance in health.
Well, all the rest of the world calls it socialism, and actually says, well, you know, that's not a swear word. Actually, that's what we are. We don't, whereas in America, it is a swear word. Nothing wrong with a bit of socialism if it keeps the cogs of society turning, is there? And then the other one. In America, 737 people out of each 100,000 people are in prison. In England, it's 148. Yes. In Australia, it's 125. Mm. Despite that, so, you know, 148 per 100,000 in prison in England compared to 737 in America. Despite that, per 100,000, 6.4 people are murdered in America compared to one. In the UK, Australia has a murder rate even lower than that, I think. It's 0.8. So got lost by another thing. You know, I can't figure this out at all. It's obviously just the American psyche about being able to carry guns. But, you know, many more people being murdered, many more people in prison, and that situation's not improving either.
Yeah, I mean, this comes down to the inability of the West in general, I think, to think in terms of a balance between extremes. You're left-wing or you're right, you're conservative or you're progressive, you're a socialist or you're a free enterprise person. They don't seem to see any potential for combinations of those. And I love how once having...
Mixed economy, we used to call it.
Yeah, but even as a mixed philosophy, the Buddhist philosophy, the idea of yin and yang, there's no perfect extremes aren't perfect. It's the balance between the two. And I remember once seeing a little movie explaining the growth of Buddhist philosophy, where it came from. And apparently, the story goes, sitting beneath a tree, some famous tree somewhere in Asia, he overheard a master teaching a young, not guitarist, but whatever the device was, stringed instrument, saying, "No, if you make it too tight, if you make it too loose, it won't make a sound at all. If you make it too tight, it'll cause a ugly sound. The balance is in the middle." And that's what gave Buddha the idea of balance. And that's partly Eastern philosophy. The Western philosophy, we get left versus right, you know, extremes. And the thing, the extremes function less well than a balanced system.
Yeah. So where does, you know, climate change aside, where does America sit in 10 years' time? It's, you know, if it's still, you think it'll still be the world's reserve currency, so it will still be the financial sector's all right. But if we continue to see this slide in manufacturing, if we still see this rise in inequality, if we see this crime rate continuing, which will only get worse, of course, as inequality increases, what happens to America?
Yeah, well, it's, again, sheer scale is you know, size isn't everything, but it's a damn sight bigger than number two. So the fact that it's so still self-contained will give it a capacity to reverse direction on occasions if needed. But overall, I think it's going to continue losing out to China in terms of technological innovation. And the only hope it's got is reshoring a lot of its production facilities, which is happening to some degree now. But they're going to find that they simply can't build those facilities up as fast as they'd like because they haven't got the trained workforce anymore because of all the outsourcing they did. So I think that's the main damage that America's done to itself. It doesn't have the engineering that it needs to build up its base capacity again, which you'd think it will need to, whereas China's got that base. So China's capacity to innovate and to produce new commodities or move in a different direction for energy systems and so on, I think is much higher than America's. So, I think this we're seeing the end of the American century. It'll still be dominant politically and militarily because of little things called nuclear weapons. But it's lost that dominance over the overall philosophy of the planet.
And what about, because we've seen gold prices rising a great deal, and that is because central banks in BRICS countries have been buying up gold, which sort of, you know, it's got people talking about whether that's to build up reserves. I mean, it's a mistake on their part, obviously, but building up reserves to back a reserve, you know, a currency that they're going to use as their means of exchange rather than using the US dollar. I mean, does that seem likely? And
it's a possibility. I mean, the oil countries have often spoken about that desire to get away from having.
Saudi Arabia's in on this, supposedly. If China's buying a whole load of oil from the Saudis and buying in whatever this new currency is going to be called, or even just buying it in the yen, what does that do to demand for the US dollar? I mean, it's going to hurt a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, it could potentially mean the US dollar falls because the exchange rate is overvalued courtesy of the, as you were saying earlier, the need to have like 90% of American dollars circulating outside America. But if you knock out the oil trade and you get a deal between the Chinese and the Saudis on that front and a range of others, and equally with Russia for minerals and so on, then you drastically reduce that demand and, yeah, the dollar will fall. Now, that actually probably...
And cost of imports in America increases.
Yeah,
but then
yeah.
It's perhaps less of an issue if they are so self-sufficient.
Really?
I mean, it makes their exports cheaper. So if they reindustrialize, they can export cheaper.
They need to do that. But you know, it's talk about giving themselves a handicap.
The handicap being that they are the reserve currency.
Yeah, that handicap, and then using that to their advantage, and then as a result of it, not wiping out, but drastically reducing their capacity for manufacturing and innovation. And that's where Boeing is the classic example of that. I think Boeing going down is a sign of how far American manufacturing has gone down.
But they must be worried about that. So you'd assume, as you say, these things can turn around, can't they? It's just a question of recognizing the extent of it all and coming up with a policy and looking at how you rebalance things, which is what we've been talking about. And that seems to be a bit of a problem that the country suffers from. Anyway, interesting discussion. We'll see how America does traverse the next decade. It's going to be interesting to watch. Good to talk this week, Steve.
Right. See you soon.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.